So what did you think at the end of Breaking Bad?
Oh, gosh. I liked it for the most part.
For the most part? What weren't you crazy about?
I guess what I wasn't crazy about was that it felt a little bit wish fulfillment-y, if that makes sense. I think it sort of yielded a bit more to Walt than I would have liked. It's sort of like everything worked out for him in that episode, even though I think it works when you take into account that everything did not work out up until that point, but it was sort of odd seeing him sort of get these sort of hero moments.
Yeah. I think all things considered, it's probably the best we could have hoped for. Like, you know, anything worse than that kind of seems a little bit violent, if that makes
sense. Yeah, no, I understand. And, like, I mean, considering that I've had my hopes dashed so many times with the endings of shows, I feel so... it feels really great to have seen it gone out on the note that it did. It's like a miracle to me. I'm like, oh my god, this didn't suck. This is great.
Well said. Welcome to Wherever You Are. My name is Ryan McNeil in Toronto, Canada, and you are listening to episode 98 of the Matinee Cast. It's the movie-loving podcast of my movie-loving website, thematinee.ca, your home for cinematic passion and perspective. Well, have you ever found yourself wanting the perspective of someone who is influenced by both Isabelle Huppert, Leonard Cohen, and Jim Henson? Well, if so, you are in luck, because that is exactly who we have in the guest seat today. Along with keeping up her own journal of comings and goings at The Cinematic Enthusiast, she also contributes to Verite, and at every turn, she writes with a great deal of honesty and wit. We're across a wire to Connecticut. We're talking to The Cinematic Enthusiast herself. Catherine Stebbins joins us. How are you tonight?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm very well. I'm actually kind of honored and somewhat surprised that this is actually your first podcast appearance, because
yeah.
It seems like something you should have done a long time ago.
Possibly. Yeah, I get nervous, so I sort of have avoided it like the plague. But,
I see. On episode 98, we will be discussing Escape from Tomorrow. We will be taking listener feedback about Disney films that scared people, and we'll be flipping the record over to play the other side. First, we need to learn more about Catherine. This is Know Your Enemy. Okay, Catherine, do tell. What is the first film you can remember seeing in a theater?
The first film that I can remember seeing in a theater is a film that still is really formative for me and means very, very... It means pretty much everything to me, and it's Beauty and the Beast.
Okay.
Yeah, I saw it, I think, maybe around 3 or 4, like, when it came out in theaters.
Holy crap, I'm old!
that's the earliest back I can remember, and it sort of became like everything to me as a child. So
yeah, well, it's kind of funny, because kind of playing off that, it, like, even though I was older than you when I saw it, it struck a chord for me in the way that animation hadn't ever, I think. Yeah. Do you remember like who took like the experience of going to see it, like who took you or where you went or anything like that?
No, I remember nothing about the experience, but I do remember. Not so much remember, but have evidence of, like, we have these, like, baby videos, and I basically in all of them am just performing these very elaborate lip sync routines to these songs of Beauty and the Beast.
Wow.
Including, like, Kill the Beast, like the song where they've all got the pitchforks, and it's so dramatic. I can see how much it meant to me, just sort of that it was everything. It still is. It's one of my favorite films. It brings me back every time I see it.
I think I'd pay good money to see a young girl singing Kill the Beast with great gusto. That would probably make a...
Lots of rage.
Yeah, definitely. What's one of the last movies you watched?
I didn't love it, but I liked it enough that I think that more people should see it, and it's called The Entity.
I have not even heard of this movie, so do tell.
Basically, it came out in 1983. It's with Barbara Hershey, and it sort of is a take on the poltergeist trend of that time.
Okay.
And it's just about her getting, like, sexually assaulted repeatedly by a ghost, by an entity.
I think I have heard of this.
Yeah, it's, like, Martin Scorsese listed it as one of, like, the 11 scariest horror films or something. Like, there was a time when, a few years ago, where he sort of wrote what he thought were the scariest films, and that was on it. That was the first time I heard of it.
Okay.
There's a lot of pacing issues. I don't like the turn that it takes towards the end. It sounds like such a gimmick, and it sounds really exploitative and really problematic, but I found the way that they handled it to be pretty harrowing and pretty honest, and it sort of focuses everything on her trauma and what she's going through and just sort of the inescapability of it. And and everyone sort of thinks that she's the root of the problem because obviously it sounds crazy. And I think it sort of speaks to sort of a, I don't know. I just like the way that it handled the topic, considering that it sounded like this was going to be a disaster. And then I watched it and I was like, this is actually pretty good. And Barbara Hershey's unbelievable.
She gets like sexually assaulted by a ghost, doesn't she?
Yeah. No. Yeah. That's like,
okay. You know, I'm thinking of the right one. And it's from 1983. Yeah, you know what's funny? So I've like a lot of people, I've been kind of going through a lot of horror movies in October and watching ones that I've never seen before and that I feel like I should have seen by now. There's a stretch of time from like 1970, or like I'll even kind of back it to like Rosemary's Baby in 68 to about 1984 or so, where things get really dark.
Yeah, you're right.
You know, it's not so much like after that, it kind of turns into slashers and monsters. But for a while there, things were really, really twisted. And that sounds like that's really, really emblematic of that whole trend.
Very much so. It's sort of like plumbing the depths that like it's just like, oh, OK, Poltergeist, what can we do with this? How can we take this a step further? By all accounts, it should not have worked.
Cool.
Very touchy subject matter. And it's, you know, but it's Barbara Hershey. I mean, even if you don't like the rest of the film, Barbara Hershey is she's unreal in this movie.
I might not even wait till next October. Thank you for that one. I'm going to mark that down. Catherine, what's one of the worst films you've ever seen?
All right, I wanted to pick something that maybe some people kind of like, but I don't know. Okay, I don't know how many people like it because I hate it. New York Stories.
Okay, this ought to get interesting. Now, okay, time out because that's kind of a. That's kind of a different answer because in case people haven't seen New York Stories, it's a compendium film, an omnibus film of three stories in one, directed by either Scorsese, Woody Allen, or Coppola. So my question then, I guess you've prompted a sub question for the first time in 98 episodes, is all of it or one specific or more than one specific?
More than one specific.
Okay, so there's one that you like.
Well, no, there's one I tolerate.
Oh, okay. So do tell.
I don't hate the Martin Scorsese one.
Okay.
I didn't like it when we were when I was watching it. Right. But then I saw the last two, and it sort of seemed seemed wonderful in comparison. The Francis Ford Coppola one is one of the worst things I have ever seen. And I really hated the Woody Allen one. Like, hated it. Like, it... I can't even talk about it. Like, it just... It makes me so angry. No, I think that it just... I think that my least favorite film of his that I've seen is Whatever Works.
Okay.
And this is, like... I think that this over... Like, this little short overtook. It's, like, when she's, like, the mother's in the sky or whatever. Like, at that point, I'm just... It just... I couldn't do it.
Yeah. It's kind of one of these things is that, you know, as much as I've been growing fonder and fonder of short films over the last year, not every short film works. And strangely, sometimes a 35 minute film can feel like an eternity. It's kind of funny. I wasn't that bad with the Woody Allen one. I didn't even finish the Coppola one. I found that to be the most indulgent thing I have seen in so long.
No, this is why you don't let your 16-year-old daughter write a film. Like, write a script that you shoot. Like, it's his fault for, like, indulging her to the point where, okay, we're going to make this. It's the most, like, self-indulgent, precocious nonsense of, like, this little girl, she's perfect and she's going to fix everyone's life, but it's... have this really awesome party, and it's horrible.
Yeah, so it sounds, by the sound of it, you've got like three talented people making things below their level, and on top of everything else, you've got some self-indulgence happening in something that should be very brief and to the point.
Yeah, and but the Scorsese one was interesting because I really didn't like it very much when I was watching it, but it sort of has stuck with me. Like, I found it at least memorable in some ways, and Rosanna Arquette is fantastic in that. I really, really enjoyed her performance.
Absolutely. Okay. I can't argue with you because, as I said, I've seen it and it's not great. It's certainly lesser work by all three involved, mm-hmm. especially with Coppola. What is a classic or essential film that you have not yet seen?
I've got two. I mean, I'm pretty good with like the sort of American canon. One that I haven't seen yet is Cool Hand Luke.
Ooh.
Yeah, I haven't seen that one. I haven't seen HUD either, so I'm kind of like behind on Paul Newman.
A little bit. And sorry, you said you had two. So what's the other one?
Yeah, the other one is Wings of Desire.
Oh.
I haven't seen any films by Wim Wenders.
Okay.
So that's a big one.
I haven't seen a lot by Wim Wenders. I would say Wings of Desire. That's like kind of a modern classic. It's like what 20 something years old now, right? Like 24 years old now.
Yeah.
And no, do not see City of Angels instead and think that you've done it to anybody who might have that going through their brain. Not that Catherine would. It's very contemplative. Like it's got that very it's really really beautiful and very very subtle. Actually, it's a film I like it, but I can't just throw it on for yucks. You know, it's something that I need to sit and watch, but it is really really beautiful. Cool Hand Luke is just so much fun. It's a little bit more style and story. It's not exactly a complicated plot, but it's kind of got like, you can kind of lump it in as one of those 60s cool movies, like with The Great Escape.
Oh, I love The Great Escape.
Yeah, if you love The Great Escape, you would probably really like Cool Hand Luke, or The Dirty Dozen, like that kind of, you know, like guys movie for sorry for the term, but it's probably the best way I could think to explain it. It's a lot of fun. It's like that one's not really gonna, you know, change your outlook on life or anything like that, but it's just the next time you've got like a Saturday night and you're bored, throw that on, and it's so much fun to watch. And Paul Newman is hot as hell in that movie.
Yeah, no, I've seen I'm just like, why haven't I watched this? Yeah, no.
Lose yourself in the steely blue eyes. Yeah, yeah. And last but not least, what's a film that for any reason you wish you had made?
This question threw me off because this is not something I think about.
Oh.
Like, ever. I don't know why. I didn't realize until I had to find something to answer the question with. I was just like, I don't really think about what I would have wanted to make. But I really would have liked to have made Hannah and Her Sisters.
Oh, okay. Why that one?
I think that the female characters are just so strong in it. And I think that the way he deals with the subject of death and mortality and coming to terms with it is something that struck such a chord with me. And in a way where I was just like, I wish I had done that. Especially just that scene in the theater where he's watching Duck Soup.
Yeah.
It's so stunning to me, and it's just everything he's saying is just, it's like he's saying things that I thought but could never articulate, and it's just, I don't know, it just sort of made me want to have made that film, I guess. Hmm.
See, it's funny because, like, first of all, when you know, certainly when somebody thinks of Woody Allen films, that's certainly one of like the first five they're going to think of for sure. It's funny that you mentioned that because I gravitate towards the look of a film an awful lot, and when I think about the look of Hannah and Her Sisters, I always think about how he does this in all of his movies, but he seems to go crazy with it in Hannah with Her Sisters. He keeps the camera back, so you get things like columns in the way, or furniture in the way, or even just a door frame in the way of the conversation.
Yeah.
As in, you know, like, we're not really in the room. We're kind of eavesdropping, and I really like that.
I'm, like, obsessed with the scene where the three of them have lunch together.
Yeah.
The three sisters, and the camera's just sort of rotating around them, and it's just... That scene, that might be my favorite scene.
Yeah. See, and it's funny because I always go back to the bookstore scene.
Oh, yes. There's so many great scenes.
We could do a whole show. Actually, considering our subject matter today, we might have been better off doing a whole show about Hannah and Her Sisters. But thank you. That's a great, these are all great answers. And hey, I even got something I got to go watch later. So thank you for that. That is an awful lot about Catherine. And we're going to find out an awful lot about you right after this. It's your chance to come talk to me. So come on back after this short break.
Why are you shaking like a leaf? Come on, come talk to me. Oh, please talk to me.
So in honor of today's feature film, Escape from Tomorrow, which has a very Disney-centric theme to its story, I kind of tapped onto something that has come up an awful lot with the question of what is the first film you've ever seen. I've heard the answer of Walt Disney films an awful lot, and also I've heard And It Scared Me an awful lot, which is kind of funny. So Catherine, did anything in Beauty and the Beast scare you when you saw it as a 3-year-old?
Yeah, actually just the mob mentality.
See, there it is.
Yeah, there, I mean, it. It's not out. I don't think it's as sort of overtly scary as some things, and I can see how it might not scare a child watching it, but for me, just the idea, just the anger that they have towards this creature, who of course we have grown to love.
Yeah, freaked you out.
Was, I had a very hard time dealing with this.
Well, the internet did respond. We had quite a few answers. Rick Vance said, the Disney question is easy, and it is a scene that still works and is terrifying to this day. The donkey scene in Pinocchio, which that was my first movie ever, Pinocchio. And that scene, like, that, nothing in that movie scared me, but I can totally see it. Like, kids start turning into animals, right?
Still, to this day, I have a really hard time watching. I'm not joking. It's terrifying.
There we go. Nick Hat, Zara, from Dubai, not Mumbai. I think you know my Disney knowledge is somewhat lacking. Last year, I did my animation marathon. I did catch up with a number of them, and I was absolutely freaked out by Dumbo. I found it to be one of the most depressing movies I've ever seen, and I was fairly sure that I would be frightened shitless as a kid, especially the whole hallucination scene with the flying elephants. Who puts that in a children's movie? She finishes her thought by saying Walt Disney was weird. Spoiler alert, people, Dumbo's going to come up a lot. And I was lucky enough a while ago to actually talk on mic with Walter Murch, who's the editor who worked on Apocalypse Now and The English Patient and a lot of those movies. He actually directed Return to Oz, and he actually said his first movie he ever saw was Dumbo, and that it scared him. So anytime I read that, I'm like, well, you're in good company. Nick's co-host on the Across the Universe podcast, Matt Kowalski from Germany, said there are lots of Walt Disney movies that have some scary elements, especially when you're a child. Not that I dislike that aspect. The one Disney movie that I have the most scary memories of is Alice in Wonderland, which I swear I saw only once. The weird world was just too much for me. And now that I think of it, Pinocchio almost always seemed very scary to me, which is why I'm pretty sure I've never seen it all the way through. Well, Matt, you might want to skip section 4 of this podcast because we are going to be talking about Alice in Wonderland. But I don't know. Maybe we'll get to it later. But I didn't really see it as scary.
No, me neither. I nothing from Alice in Wonderland ever really scared me.
Yeah. Jessica in Sweden from the Velvet Cafe said, I've honestly never thought of a Disney movie as being particularly frightening. Perhaps I was too old when I watched most of them, but there is one that comes to mind, The Jungle Book. There are a couple truly creepy villains in it, Ka and Shere Khan. And the ones that aren't exactly villains are still frightening, like the scene where the crazy, unpredictable King Louie. I was going to say.
Best scene ever. Okay.
Yeah. Well, there, of course, is a lot of joy in this film. It still manages to capture the vulnerability of the child as Mowgli confronts the dangers of the jungle, an image that we all risk to meet once we leave our homes and start exploring the world. At heart, it's a coming of age story, scary stuff indeed. It's kind of one of those things I always liked about Disney, like as crazy as they go. And let's be honest, they go kind of crazy for something that's supposed to be family friendly. I like that they teach children to be afraid and that, you know, the fear will be okay in the end.
Exactly. Yeah. And that is exactly part of what I love about The Jungle Book is that it's at the end, it's really building up to this moment where he's ready to be on his own or to sort of venture out.
On Facebook, Sue Maynard said, this doesn't really count, but Sweetums from The Muppets freaked me out, but they weren't Disney then. Lady in White and Watcher in the Woods were both scary. I think those were both Disney live action.
Yeah.
And yeah. At least, yeah.
Betty Davis one.
Yeah, and at least one of them is Disney. The hyenas and the Lion King are pretty disturbing when they're in a group, and I can't think of anything that scared me much as Disney as a kid. More now that I'm supposed to be adult. Anything where it looked like an animal was going to get hurt was scary, though. The bear scene in The Fox and the Hound, for example. Yeah, that is the one thing. Disney liked killing animals.
This is true.
But it's kind of one of those things.
To experience.
Yeah, so, yeah. No kidding. Dan Heaton, the public transportation snob, said, I had an inexplicable scared reaction to the Heffalumps and Woozles in the Winnie the Pooh and the Blustery Day as a kid. Now it just seems like animators were on drugs. But back then it was pretty frightening. Hattoria Swanson said, my father had to remove me from the theater. I was sobbing and screaming hysterically after taking me to see his favorite, Fantasia, when I was 3 or 4. I was afraid of the lines. I think she means like the Beethoven thing where it's just a series of squiggles.
Abstract. Yeah.
Yeah. And
then, like interlude where they're like, this is what this instrument sounds like. And you see this, the line sort of making the sound waves or...
Yeah. She says she doesn't actually know what that means because to this day, 30 years later, she's never even tried to watch it again. I can only think that that's what she was getting at. And if that's true, that's pretty early on.
Yeah. No, that's the first segment.
Yeah. I have no problem with Jaws, The Shining, Salem's Lot, or The Exorcist at that age. Fantasia, though, not happening. Corey Pierce from the Critical Mass cast said The Pink Elephants in Dumbo. There's that movie again. Titania Plant, the classic flick chick. I always stumble over that. Pretty much all of Alice in Wonderland creeped me out. Also the transformation scene in Snow White.
Yes, that's the one I was waiting for.
Oh, and the creepy, awful stepmother in Cinderella, who's always in the shadows. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they light her as if she's like holding a flashlight on her chin the whole time, don't they?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Yeah, that would mess me up. How did I get past all of this? Because I was a scared little kid. Oh, man. Sean Kelly from SKL Movies said, even though they were made for TV, no Disney production has scared me more than the two Boogeyman films from 1986 and 87. A few more from Twitter. Bubba Wheat, Flights, Tights, and Movie Nights said, honestly, I can't think of any Disney films that freak me out, though when I grew up loving The Secret of Nim, Dark Crystal, and Return to Oz, and a very obscure animated movie called A Mouse and His Child, those were all more freaky than any Disney I remember. Yeesh. Yeah. Daniel McCarthy in England said, even years later and as distant memory as I can get, the wood scene from Snow White, the woods, like out when she's out and running out in the forest, still sends a faint shudder down my spine. Hey, do you remember that part where like the trees are grabbing after her?
Yeah, it's very strange and it's really interesting animation, actually. Yeah. That's sort of what I think that's why it scares me less, that scene now, because I'm just sort of paying attention to what the animation looks like. But it's, yeah, the trees sort of become these weird face shapes and everything's distorted and it's like she can't get out. And it's very. Yeah.
No, it's bleak. Yeah. Finally, my last one, Rachel West tweeted, watch her in the woods. Betty Davis is terrifying in every movie. She goes on to say, my first time in a cinema, my mom had to escort me out during Song of the South because I was terrified of the animated bluebird. I wonder if she was terrified by the overt racism, but
yeah.
Well, it's kind of like the funny thing was she went after tweeting that there was a conversation that happened between her and Jake Cole, who lives in Alabama. And he said, I've never even seen this movie. She goes, I'm pretty sure it's never getting seen again because of just how, you know, they make it seem like the guy is very happy to be a slave and they just want to make everybody forget about it. Yeah. That's a lot of therapy that we've just gone through with my listeners. Catherine, what about you? Did you have any one of these that freaked you out as a kid?
Yeah, I mean, the Pinocchio one is really relevant to my experience of it. It's still to this day, I have a hard time watching anything with them on Pleasure Island, with the coachman, with them turning into donkeys. All of it is absolutely frightening to me, to the point where I don't even put it on for that reason.
You know what I think of when I think of that too, that might be the most freaky about that whole scene is the fact that they turn into donkeys for no reason.
Yeah, no, it's just that they're sort of like doing things that are conceived as being.
Yeah.
Like they're smoking cigars, so they turn into donkeys.
Yeah, they're doing what's put in front of them.
But no one knows, like their parents don't know where they are.
No. Yeah.
They can't talk anymore. Like that, just, I really can't deal with that. It's too much. And Snow White, the transformation scene, the scene where she transforms into the sort of old crone. She put that spell together, and then there's this shot of like she drops the glass and her eyes just go so wide and her hair's flowing and it turns gray and like the camera, like it's just like it's spinning around, like the shot is just spinning around her. And it's, I have a thing with faces. Freaky faces are what freak me out more than anything you can ever conceive of. Like the end of Don't Look Now, the end of Invasion of the Body Snatchers. These are the things that creep me out more than anything. So seeing her face like that, that really sticks with me to this day.
Oh, wow. You know what's kind of sick in my head? I've all of a sudden decided I almost want to come up with like a YouTube supercut of all these moments.
You're evil. That's awful.
You know what the thing is? I guarantee you Disney would have that shit down in about 30 seconds. So
that's true.
Might just have to keep it for me. I'm going to cheat a little bit. As easy as it was to scare me as a child, I never actually got frightened by the Disney films, but I did get super duper duper freaked out during, if not my first, then one of my first trips to Disney World as a child. And I mean, by this time I was like 10. So I was like way beyond the point where this sort of crap should have been affecting me. And I got freaked out in the Haunted Mansion. Which is absurd, because I go through that now. I went through it like 4 years later. I went through it like as a 14-year-old, and I was like, what the hell was wrong with me? But when you go in it, like, you're, you know, they lead you through like the kind of line, you hear like the organ music playing, and it's all this gothic mansion and everything like that. And then you go into this room, and it's a room that can hold maybe 30 or 40 people, not very big. Mm-hmm. And it's the elevator down into like the actual part of like the cars that actually take you through the mansion. But the way that the room itself feels like it's stretching, and this weird guy is narrating what you're about to see, and then they cut the lights. And that just, for me as 10 years old, I was like, nope, can't do it. I went through the whole mansion with my eyes, my hands over my eyes. I got a cop to that, because even though none of these moments affected me, that moment, and it's absurd. As I said, if anybody goes through it now and looks at it, they'd be like, this is silly. How could this ever scare you as a child? I have no idea. It was just, you know, I think it was just because it was like all around me.
You're stuck there. You can't.
Yeah.
Have to see what they're.
You gotta go through. Same thing as the movie. You gotta go through it. Otherwise, you're not gonna. You know, there's no turning back.
Exactly.
Yeah. Maybe it's worse actually, because you can leave.
It's also, you're just sort of part of the atmosphere. You're like in the middle of it, even if it's not scary. Yeah.
So even though it is all funny and friendly and everything like that, the Disney Haunted Mansion at Walt Disney World in Orlando scared me as a 10-year-old child. I wasn't even like, I was old enough to know better, and it still just totally got me. So that's me copping to that one. You know, make fun of me as you will. For episode 99 in 2 weeks, the feedback question is this, and it is thanks to Brian J. Rowan from dearfilm.net. The question is, if you could change the ending to any film, what would the film be and what would you change? Let me know. Ryan@thematinee.ca, Twitter, where I am matinee_CA, or Facebook, facebook.com/darkmatinee. We are going to the new slang right after this. The new slang this episode is Escape from Tomorrow. Escape from Tomorrow is written and directed by Randy Moore. Escape from Tomorrow stars Roy Amson, Elena Shuler, Caitlin Rodriguez, and Jack Dalton. And it is about the White family who are on vacation in Walt Disney World in Orlando, Florida. Right off the top of the film, the father, Jim White, that's Abramson, he gets a cell phone call from his boss telling him that he's been laid off. And this must make something snap in Jim's brain, because the rest of that day at the Magic Kingdom and Epcot Center, he just starts seeing shit, and craziness ensues. So, Catherine, when word of this film first went out from Sundance, the story seemed amazing. Here we had a film that was shot covertly and illegally inside of the Magic Kingdom and Epcot Center and Disneyland in California, actually seeing the light of day without Disney's notorious legal team pulling the plug. That it was made, shown, and later given a full-on release was almost too incredible to be true. So, pop quiz hotshot. Was Escape from Tomorrow handcuffed by this whole production story? Was it, in fact, competing with itself?
Ooh, good question. I think it's sort of competing with itself.
I'll elaborate, because this was what was coming. This is the difficulty for me, was just hearing the remarkable story that this guy was able to actually film this stuff. Mm. He even said that more than a few moments he was getting tailed by security, because he was filming it on like consumer level cameras, which was how he got away with it in the first place, was he just looked like a tourist. So the fact that he was able to pull off the filming, get it shown at Sundance, and, you know, like, and word coming back from Sundance was just like, everybody thought it was fantastic. They weren't going over the moon about it. Like, it wasn't like the must-see movie of 2013, but everybody who saw it was really, really smitten with it. But everybody thought, they were happy they saw it at Sundance, because it was never going to get shown. You know, they're like, Disney is going to shut this shit down for sure. But Disney laid off for all kinds of reasons. And, you know, you got to see it on demand. I got to see it in a theater. And it, like, that whole run-up narrative, it almost feels like that was just too much to live up to. Like, you know, it's in a weird way, it's kind of like the indie film hype that goes along with the Avengers.
Yeah, no, it was very strange. I mean, you've sort of, the only context that you're hearing about it is this sort of like, oh my God, how did this get made? How is it possible that we could see this in a theater?
Yeah, we got to see this movie.
Yeah, like we got to see it just because this is crazy that it even exists. How does this even exist? And then you go in and you sort of, that novelty aspect of it, once
you get
used.
Wears off kind
of
quick, don't it?
It wears off pretty damn quick. I got to say, it lasted a good 15 minutes.
Yeah, I read your tweets, so I know what's coming. But tell people, what did you think of Escape from Tomorrow?
Oh, I don't often hate things. to preface it, I really don't. I you know, there's usually something I can sort of find, or, you know, I try to just, I don't know, I guess see what it's trying to get at or see if I can take anything from it and all of that. There's really only a handful of films I really, really actively dislike a year. And Escape from Tomorrow, unfortunately, is one of the films that I really had a very negative reaction.
Now what didn't you like? Like, what most importantly, like, didn't you like about it? What was the one thing that was really, really stuck in your craw?
Probably the fact that it could not actually make a story out of what it was trying to do. Because the idea is, I think it's a decent idea. There's something there. It's, you know, it is interesting inherently, but it never was able to settle on anything interesting or coherent or interestingly incoherent or any of that. It just sort of wants to desperately be this sort of like reactionary take on Disney and sort of the idea of like manufactured happiness and all of this. And I just don't think that for all the trouble that it took to make this thing, I don't see how it was in any way, shape, or form worth it.
Yeah.
Considering the end result.
Yeah, see, you kind of touch on something with incoherent madness, where it's like, in a lot of ways, I almost feel like they didn't go far enough.
Exactly. No, that was sort of my problem with it too, especially with the way that there's sort of like some satirical stuff thrown in, but it doesn't like, but it's never, the tone of it is never consistent. It wasn't consistent enough for me. I feel like everything should have been taken much farther if we were going to go down this road. Just like commit to it, take it a notch higher, like. Yeah. Make it crazier, because it's the way it reads on screen was so flat to me.
Yeah, no, I'm with you. I'm totally with you. I was really, really let down with this movie. One of the first things that jumps to mind when I think about this movie now, and I think one of the reasons why I really didn't like it, is a great deal of the plot of this movie, if I can call it that, is on Jim spending a lot of time busting after these two French women.
God.
Let me set this up. So he gets the call that says he's fired. The family piles into the monorail and they head off to the Magic Kingdom. Like, we're with them for all of about 2 minutes. And when they get into the monorail, he sees these two French girls. I'm going to say they're like, what, 18? Tops?
They seemed younger than that.
Okay. So so let's somewhere between 15 and 18. You know, they're very, very friendly. They're very French. And Jim spends most of the movie either within Disney or later on at the hotel pool, just basically chasing after these girls like a horny freshman. Mm-hmm. And like, don't get me wrong, I know that there are guys out there who are like that. But when you've got this whole movie and you're trying to pitch me on a guy who's lost his job and we're supposed to feel sorry for him and he's having this mental break, watching him have this, like, you know, horny chase with his wife and kids in tow, especially with his kids in tow, like, that was where I was really, really not digging it. Like, he's got it, like, he's basically pulling his son by the arm onto every ride that these women go on. And I'm like, this is not doing it for me.
No. So. No, not at all. Oh my God. No, it's strange. I did not expect going into this movie that at the very least a third of it, and I'm being kind with saying a third of it, is you're just watching this guy follow to like teenage French girls.
Yeah.
That's what you're watching. And that's it. I was just really taken aback that this was how we were spending, our runtime. Yeah. It was very troublesome to me. It was very tiresome. It was very distancing.
One of those things that comes to mind for me is, like, if that was the story he wanted to tell, dude, you can do that anywhere. Why are you bothering to shoot that in Disney World?
Yeah. Yeah, it's true. No, I don't understand why we needed to do that in this setting. It didn't, they felt what he was doing, just like chasing these girls, felt very dissonant to the whole, we're going to do this nightmarish take on Disney World. And I didn't understand how the two were meant to connect, except for this sort of like following them down like a rabbit hole type thing. And things sort of keep building and building in a sense, as far as the sort of his grip on what's actually happening. But no, I just, it was very uncomfortable.
Yeah.
It was very, very, and not in like a, you know, I'm getting, you know, this is making me think, this is thought provoking. Like none of it. It was just, you're watching this dude his character was so interesting to, I mean, it wasn't that interesting, but trying to find something to be interested in. This guy's like a doofus. We're not really supposed to take him seriously. I feel like it's a very sort of, bit over the top. We're not really supposed to like him. He's very much a jerk. He's very much a child.
Yes.
Just like the way he complains about this, the way he sort of just is about everything. Just, it seems like he's just another kid. Like he's just one of the kids. So it seems aware of that. But it doesn't actually do anything with it, because I don't understand why we just were watching him sort of, you know, these two girls, and we're seeing them through his eyes the entire time.
Yeah.
They're eating bananas, you know, they're swinging on poles, they're just being very playful with each other.
Well, they're French, right?
They're French. This is what French teenage girls do, apparently.
Of course.
You know, they're being very, like, coquettish and stuff, and they're just these, like, unattainable fantasies for him. But it's not saying anything with this.
No.
It's just, and so what it does is it just reinforces those gender dynamics and the male gaze and everything that we're seeing. It's just there. It's just, there's no twist on it.
Yeah. And again, you could have done that anyway. You know, you're wasting your efforts by telling that story there. It's kind of funny, because one of the things that I did actually like, and I kind of wanted more. Well, there's two things that I liked and that I kind of wanted more of. One is, we get this character. She's just known as the other woman. She's the only other adult character besides the two parents who really has lines. Mm-hmm. And she, we're led to believe that she used to work for Disney, and she was one of the princesses, and now she's just, you know, she's been let go because Disney's are only employed until they're like, you know, 25 or something like that. It's like being a waitress at Hooters. But she, okay, so first of all, she talks about like the amount of illusion that goes into pulling off anything Disney, right? And there is just so much manufactured happiness that goes into everything they do. It's insane of like how much actual work and control and precision goes into something that's just supposed to be magic casual observer. And I kind of like that. Like, I kind of wish that, he would have gone more into the nuts and bolts of what makes things happen. And then as well, you also, because you're talking to a grown woman, what happens to somebody after they leave? Because there are people who are like asked to leave Disney. There are people who quit Disney. There are people who, you know, they do their time and then they move on. Just the same as, this sounds absurd. I promise you, and I acknowledge, but the same as, you know, what happens to soldiers after the war is over. I would love to see about what happens to Disney employees after the songs have stopped and the cartoon is over. And we get like, we just get a sliver of that when this woman is talking, and that goes to a really dark and twisted place.
It does, yeah.
But then, you know, there's French girls to watch.
Of course. We've got to get back to that. I don't know. I guess working at Disney, it just must be such a unique, idiosyncratic experience that it's true. Like where is there any other place for this?
No, not in my brain.
Maybe. No, I can't think of any.
Like not in Western culture.
Exactly. It's such a strange construct.
Yeah.
That's something that I was thinking about, I guess, you know, because I was trying to figure out, okay, well, what could he have gotten out of filming all of this in Disney World, and what really were we going for here? And I guess it did sort of get me thinking about just how overwhelmingly present Disney is in our lives.
Oh, yeah.
And it's something that I guess I took for granted. But when you start thinking about just how much of a touchstone it is for everybody.
Yep.
At some point, at least in like Western culture, for everybody, it's pretty incredible to me, at least.
Oh, absolutely! Like, well, it's an empire, really.
Yeah,
like it's something that I don't know any other business or art form that has done what Walt Disney has done. Like, you know, starting just as Goons and turning that into just this gigantic business, all pointed at family happiness. Like, that's the thing. Anytime something gets even kind of adult, they throw it over into one of their other brands, like, you know, I don't know if they still own it, but like Miramax or Touchstone or ABC or one of those. But if it's got that castle on it, and if Tinkerbell comes out and does her little thing, it's all very, very happy. And it's huge, and it's omnipresent. And like you said, it's like nothing else in culture.
No, and it's the trickle-down effect of it is so interesting, too, because it is this impossibly ginormous empire, and yet it's managed to touch all of these people in such, you know, ways that feel individual to us, but that are pretty shared, but it still means so much, and so it just, the way it trickles down to the individual in just really emotional ways that are sort of formative, again, it's very, very, it's a very interesting spectrum.
Yeah. One of the little things that actually kind of got me about this film that it was one of those moments where it actually threw me off axis pretty quick. Like, as if the film didn't do it enough. Was it my imagination, or did he kind of start going crazy a little too quick? Because he gets on that first ride. He gets on, I think it's like a Snow White ride, too. And he's already seeing things for no reason other than he lost his job that day.
Yeah, that's true.
And it's Florida and it's hot.
Yeah. And then the little eyes sort of start shifting a bit. And that happens very early.
Yeah.
Like 15 minutes in, I think.
Yeah. It was a strange thing because on paper, a fever dream set in any world seems to write itself because there is some crazy shit in that park.
Yeah, there really is. Yeah.
But it felt like he just. You know, he went off the handle a little too fast. We'll kind of come back to that in The Shining, but it'll be a neat little comparison. But that was my first thing. It's like there's no reason for him to all of a sudden start seeing things. Was there anything else that jumped out? I think people could probably sense our disappointment in this movie. But was there anything else that jumped out, either positive or negative, about Escape from Tomorrow?
Sort of going further with just sort of the way that the teenage girls are portrayed, and I guess this the place that they have in the film. I had an equally hard time with the wife character.
Yeah, I did too.
Very unsympathetic, very shrill, nagging, sort of just typical wife who doesn't stop bothering the husband. There was nothing more to it. She's got one scene, pretty much. Like, she has like no time on her own. She's like waiting for the husband to show up. And then there's that moment where she herself sees the French girls and their faces turn. There's that moment. But, like, she doesn't have – she's just very – it's just very, very reductive. The gender dynamics just felt very, very problematic. And just her – just when she's complaining about the necklace or the little bell that he gives her.
Yeah. She got the wrong bell.
It's like, oh, okay. And she's, like, close up with the camera and she's in her face. And it's just what are we doing here?
It's kind of funny because on the one hand, I might see that as just a writing mistake as he was doing this screenplay and he didn't realize the sort of treatment that he was giving this character because, you know, he's a typical guy and he can't write women. But, you know, there's one thing that actually tipped me off that was really deliberate and it really actually made me like that choice even less. And that is, you got to be really watching it'll pass by. But at one point, he gets a call from her. I think it's like at the moment when they're separated in the park, he gets a call from her and the photo of her on his phone. She has a really, really grumpy and confused look. Like, she's confused at him and shrugging. And it is...
I didn't even notice that.
Yeah. I don't know why I noticed it. It was one of those things. I think because it is not possibly a picture that anybody in their right mind would assign to anyone, first of all, let alone their wife. And I'm like, okay, director guy, you deliberately chose that image with her looking all confused and condescending to really drive the point home. And you take that and you put it with the friends. It's like, you just don't like women in this movie.
No, and it's strange because I really was trying to give them the benefit of the doubt and figure out, okay, are we trying to say something? Because again, it feels very purposely put there. He seems aware of it.
Yeah.
It feels like he's aware of what he's doing. On at least on some level, like, and I'm just was trying to figure out what kind of take on middle class nightmare is this, what kind of riff on sort of this white male fantasy is this, what, like, and I couldn't find any point to it. I just couldn't. And so then again, you're just left with what's there, and what's there is just pretty unsettling for all the wrong reasons.
No, I hear you. Well, I'm almost afraid to ask this part, but, you know, we do end the review, by talking about something that we would keep. So, you know, if you could go through the souvenir shop of the movie, that's basically one big Disney souvenir shop, and keep any one thing that you think is redeeming or was kind of cool or, you know, had potential, is there anything that you would keep from Escape from Tomorrow as a souvenir?
That sort of scene where they are sort of in the Snow White ride.
Yeah.
I did find, like, and when the faces aren't changing, because I didn't find that effective, but, like, just sort of the way the ride is photographed with the Winnie the Pooh and the Queen and the dwarves and that sort of whole sequence where we're going through either Snow White or Winnie the Pooh, I found that to be interestingly photographed. Roy Abramson, is that his name?
Yep.
He made me chuckle a couple times, and that's pretty much it.
I like the fact that this movie was in black and white because, like, when I think of Disney, I think of very, very bright colors. I think of, like, the Instagram super saturation filter. I never would think about Disney World and Disneyland or anything Disney related as black and white. So seeing it that way actually kind of lent itself to something really novel.
Yeah.
Of course, just like most of this movie, the novelty wears off. But if and when I go back to Disney World, I can only think to myself, I will be taking pictures in black and white. Well, we end our reviews with a rating. I wonder if the defeat is audible in my voice. Rating films on a scale of 1 to 4 stars. So, Catherine Stebbins, what do you give Escape from Tomorrow?
One.
Yeah. You know what? I think when I wrote about it, I gave it a 2. But in the week since, it has fallen a little bit more in my brain. I got to give it a 1.5. And the 1.5 is only for the fact that he was able to get this even seen.
It's mere existence.
Yeah. Yeah. Nothing. Yeah. The story behind the story is where it gets everything. Yeah. Hey, maybe we're wrong. I really don't think so. But if you don't want to take our word for it, check out Escape from Tomorrow and let me know what you think. Ryan at thematinee.ca, matinee_ca on Twitter or facebook.com/darkmatinee. We will be back after this with some much happier things, sort of, on the other side. So come on back. So before we get into the other side, I must say that in the 48 episodes or so that I've been doing the feature this way, this must be the most random pairing of movies that we are going to come up with. But this was fantastic. When I had these two DVDs sitting on my shelf, I had to smile because it was great. Catherine's choice for The Other Side goes back to 1951. It is a Walt Disney animated classic. It's Alice in Wonderland. It was directed by Clyde Geronimi, Wilfred Jackson, and Hamilton Lusky. Everybody knows the story of Alice in Wonderland, so I'm not even really going to recounting the plot. My question, I guess, Catherine, is of all the Disney films, because that was kind of the obvious theme. If you didn't choose a Disney movie, I would have. Why this one?
I mean, it sort of just goes back to, like, the down the rabbit hole aspect of Escape from Tomorrow and just sort of I did want to pick a Disney movie because I was so mad at Escape from Tomorrow that I'm just trying to find all these really superficial ways to stick it to the film and just, like, watch Disney movies. So that was one of the reasons I picked Alice in Wonderland. But no, the other one is just that I just think that this film particularly combines the surreal aspects of the source material and the brand of Disney in a much more harmonious and interesting way than something like Escape from Tomorrow, which sort of tries to take the Disney brand and turn it into something surreal and is not really able to make it come together. together.
Well, it's sort of funny because Alice is really it's actually disjointed. Have you ever read the book?
I have, yes.
So I don't know about you, but when I read it for the first time, I want to say 4 or 5 years ago. And I really found myself surprised by the fact that there wasn't so much a plot as it was just Alice stumbling from one scene into another scene into another scene. And, you know, she wakes up, you know, like when we get to Through the Looking Glass, things get a little bit better.
It's very episodic and very much just she's trying to make her way through these different encounters and to varying degrees of success.
Yeah.
And it's sort of the things that she feels like she thought that she wanted ends up being not really what she wanted at all. She wants things to make sense and things to be sort of rational again.
Yeah. And it's kind of funny because this, of course, came not terribly long after Fantasia. And in some ways, I think that they're mirror films. They're Walt Disney basically just playing jazz and being all imaginative and restrained by nothing, not even a story.
Yeah, Fantasia is like top 10 material for me. I'm like completely obsessed with Fantasia.
Oh yeah.
And it's true though that there's this very sort of slightly, I mean, well, Fantasia gets pretty abstract at points.
It's extremely abstract.
Yeah, but then on the other end of it, there are certain sort of vignettes that tell very distinct, very, very, very clear
stories.
And so with Alice in Wonderland, it's, you know, they're all part of the same story, but the encounters are very, very just sort of dissonant and sort of the same frustrations keep popping up and she's not really getting anywhere. And it's really only when she gets to the Queen where there's any kind of goal or anything sort of forward motion established is really when she gets to her destination.
Well, it's kind of funny because we get all the way through Wonderland and then finally so she starts out hopeful and incredulousness just kind of soaks in after about a minute or two, because whether it's the Mad Hatter and the March Hare or whether it's the flowers or you know, any of the or the Tweedledee and Tweedledum, she can see that she's just not going to get anywhere.
Yeah.
By the time we get to the Queen, all of a sudden it's this one is a threat. This is a problem. So it's kind of funny that it does build to that. But before that, it's just a whole bunch of things that were inconsequential.
Yeah. We're just focusing on sort of how eccentric these characters are or what's this next song going to be about. Or it goes into that whole Walrus and the Carpenter thing.
Yeah.
Which it makes a whole other story within a story, you know, out of, and something I'm trying to remember, cause I don't know any of the details about this, but I'm trying to remember cause I thought I heard at some point that I don't think Walt Disney's actually a fan of Alice in Wonderland, of the film.
That wouldn't surprise me.
Yeah.
I
want to do more, I want to figure out exactly what, you know, what he didn't like about it or what about its development upset him. Or was it something he wasn't really into from the start? I don't really know any background about it, but okay. I do remember hearing that he wasn't crazy about that particular film.
Interesting. I would be curious if anybody listening knows, leave us a comment, cause I'd really like to know, we could probably Google it by the time we're done, but hey, let's go interactive. Kind of like Fantasia, it's the Disney animators just playing jazz, right? They're letting their imaginations run wild and, you know, having flamingos as the croquet mallets and having those creatures out in Tulgi Wood. It really has them with the training wheels off, not trying to do something very, very classical like they were doing with Pinocchio and Snow White and Cinderella. And they're really just letting their imaginations run.
Yeah, exactly. It's really just about her exploring this world and seeing what the animators can come up with.
Yeah.
It can fit songs and what, you know, it's so it's definitely different in structure. And it's cool to see that, you know, they didn't try to put more to it.
No.
Because it's pretty obvious that anyone that tries to take this kind of stuff on now, it's just so overloaded with mythology and plot. And it just becomes such a different beast from what it was, which in one sense is okay because it's, you know, they're trying to, you know, do something different with it. But in another sense, it's but you've lost what was interesting about this and you haven't made it interesting on its own.
No.
So I think it is kind of cool to see that. No, they sort of stuck to it more than you would think that they would.
Yeah. In a lot of ways, it really epitomizes what Escape from Tomorrow should have been. If you are going to do this thing where a guy goes nuts in the happiest place on Earth, just get him in the park and just have him lose it. Have him, like Alice, stumble from one scene to another scene, and Walt Disney has done you the favor of setting up these scenes for you.
Yes.
And just, you know, one piece of absurdity to the next.
No, the Escape from Tomorrow obviously doesn't do that successfully. And it's really, what it's interesting about Alice in Wonderland, it's just, it sort of starts out as this dream, as this something that she thinks she wants. You know, she doesn't want to read books anymore, and she sort of wants to go off in her own world. And there's that song in the beginning, which is really underrated song, I think. But no one talks about that song, and I think it's wonderful. But it sort of just descends into this inescapable place that she just wants to get out of it.
Yeah.
And Escape from Tomorrow sort of starts out with this, oh, I'm going to follow these two. This is sort of a fantasy of mine. I'm going to follow these two girls around. And it sort of should have been a similar trajectory where it's sort of like, I don't want to do this anymore. This isn't working out the way I plan. I want to get back to normalcy, but it's not able to find a route to that there's no through line to it. That and it's just unfortunate.
Do you get the impression that director Randy Moore really, really resisted the urge to put a white rabbit on one of those French girls?
Oh my God. Yeah. I was like waiting for it. I was like,
it's like, coming. Yeah.
I was waiting for the tip off and it didn't.
No. You know, what's actually funny. This is the first time I've watched this Alice in many, many years. And as I was watching it, like very early on, it actually kind of clicked that the version I was most familiar with was actually the one that they most often show on TV. Like when they show, there used to be the show when I was younger and you were three. they used to have the Wonderful World of Disney on like Sunday nights.
Yes, yes.
Okay. So, and every once in a while, they just show a Disney animated feature. But of course, the movie minutes, you got to have commercials and everything like that. Disney only has an hour. So they had to cut shit out. So for the longest time, like I knew about this other stuff that was cut out, but it was really, really far in my memory because I hadn't seen the full version. So this is the first time in a long time, like you mentioned that song, that In a World of My Own song. This was the first time in a long time that I'd even heard that song.
They cut it out?
Yeah.
It's a lovely song.
Oh yeah. No, they, if anybody, like any, the TV version of Alice in Wonderland, they got it. Like Tweedledee and Tweedledum are gone. The Dodo and Alice getting all big in the house. That's gone. They
what?
I know. Right. So that's like, I'm watching all this and I remember it because I saw this like on video as a child. So I remember all these things way back in my head, but I'm like, this is not as familiar as the tea party and as the flowers singing. Why? I'm like, oh crap. They cut the guts out of this.
Yeah. That's not trimming. That's just like, it's a shred. That's ridiculous.
Yeah. So I was actually really, really, really thankful that you chose this because it was very much a revisit for me. There are so many things, of course, but if somebody hasn't, first of all, if somebody tragically has not seen Alice in Wonderland before, or if, you know, we're saying see it instead of Escape from Tomorrow, what's the takeaway? What, when you watched it again, what was that kind of one thing that you really, really grabbed onto?
I guess I just really love the way that, because I've seen this movie so many times, like a ridiculous amount of times. Pretty much all the Disney ones, I used to put them on repeat in high school while I did homework, so I literally had these films on hundreds and hundreds of times in the course of my life. So it's hard for me to actually draw back and figure out, okay, what do I actually get out of this, because I'm so used to it being like background stuff. But I would say I just sort of lose myself in it. It's very in a delightful way. The songs are really catchy, really, really catchy, actually. I don't know. I just sort of enjoy seeing how many eccentric characters are brought into play in such a short period of time. Because you're really, if you're not interested in something that's happening, you move on to another character in like 5 minutes. And so there's always something different going on screen, which is, I just think it's really fun.
Well said. Well, we've got another movie for you right after this, so come on back. We'll play one more other side and finish up the show after this break. Well, what better film to follow Disney's Alice in Wonderland with? And with Stanley Kubrick's 1980 horror film, The Shining, that was must for the other side. I'm not really going to spend too much time on the plot because everybody knows the plot of The Shining by now. A happy family goes up to a great big hotel. Turns out it's haunted. Dad goes nuts. Did you rewatch it for this episode, or are you going on memory here?
I did rewatch it. I've seen it a lot.
Okay.
It's a film that I was sort of introduced to at a very, very early age. Probably, I think I'd say 13, 12 or 13. And I guess isn't that early, but for me, for that type of film, it was. And I
well, certainly if at 13 you were putting on like Disney movies in the background to do homework, I can only imagine that this would be a bit of a shock to the system.
It's become a favorite of mine, obviously, and I've seen it many times. So, but I was like, oh, I'm totally up for rewatching this. For rewatching The Shining.
Yeah, this was actually my Halloween night movie. I watched this last night.
I did too.
Oh, there we go. It held up nicely, eh?
Oh, of course. It always does. I love it.
Well, it's funny about that because, you know, this is actually going to be my takeaway, but I'll just jump right to it. It's amazing to see how a film can grow in stature, because when this movie first came out, it wasn't really what people wanted from Stanley Kubrick, like what Kubrick fans wanted. It certainly wasn't what Stephen King fans wanted from their book. And people just kind of shrugged it off going, eh. But now here we are, you know, 30 some odd years later, and it's this modern classic. It's one of Kubrick's greats. It's a whole other interpretation. That's the thing I kind of love, not just about The Shining, but just about film in general, is how a piece is finished, but it's not finished, right? Like, we still kind of write the story in what we see in it and how we take to it. Certain things can diminish and certain things can grow.
Yeah. No, I think that I'm fascinated by that, especially, I guess, now as years pass, I'm starting to see some of that, like, actually happen instead of hearing about something like The Shining, where it's like, oh, yeah, this wasn't that big when it came out, but like sort of grown, and you hear about that happening all the time, and it's sort of interesting to see the years pass and see certain things that no one really talks about anymore that were really sort of very critically acclaimed at the time, and then other things that have grown and that have sort of staked their claim with a lot of people. And
yeah,
it's so fascinating.
Again, not to wail too much more on Escape from Tomorrow, but we're gonna. I mentioned it already, like that Escape from Tomorrow, the father just goes crazy, fart. And when, you know, that was kind of, I don't know why, I had it on the brain when I watched The Shining last night. I was like, I wonder how long it's going to take Jack Torrance to go nuts. And he does kind of, like, after they're left there, the thing that kind of makes it feel like he doesn't go crazy until later is that prologue of Jack's interview and of the family going up there and of the caretaker talking to Danny and talking about Shining. That all takes a really long time. Like, we don't leave the family alone for, I think, the first hour.
No, it takes quite a while to
This is a long movie in general at 143 minutes.
Here's food, you know, here's all the food, here's this room, and it does take quite a bit of time.
Yeah, so you know, but we go through all that preamble, and then we get a little bit of Jack being okay, and then he kind of starts to act really weird on like the second day. They start telling it at like Sunday, Monday, Tuesday. I think by Tuesday he's already started to lose it.
Pretty far gone. Yeah. It. I don't know if it's the Nicholson casting.
Yeah.
Or if, I mean, I'm sure it is because it's Nicholson, but like also just the performance though. To me, I see it from the first scene.
Oh, yeah?
Here's an example. When the guy that is interviewing him is telling him about what happened at the hotel.
Yeah, all right.
There's a shot, we cut back to him, and he's just staring and listening to this, and it is so creepy. It's like this dead-eyed stare that is very similar to the dead-eyed stare he has when he's in that black turtleneck.
Yeah.
Slowly zoom in. It's definitely not as exaggerated as that, but it's that very, it's like something's off here.
Yeah.
And then there's when they're driving up,
he's got a grin on his face.
There's nothing family oriented about the scene. I don't feel like they ever feel like a family unit.
No,
there's something so disconnected from the start with them.
Yeah.
And that moment where he's just like, you see, he saw it on the television.
Yeah.
It's the line delivery, the way his face is, the smile, the way he's just staring out. It's just, it's all there, like from the beginning, which I think you could argue hurts it. I think it could in a different movie, but here I think it works.
Oh, absolutely. It's definitely one of those things that I think, you know, if they had a better actor in Escape from Tomorrow, we would have bought it, because there's a lot to be said for casting. again, to contrast our main film, we talked about the role of the wife in the family unit, and I don't think you can get much better than what Shelley Duvall goes through in this movie. Like, okay, so, you know, behind the scenes, of course, she was just mercilessly picked on by Stanley Kubrick in the mid, take after take after take. He would berate her. Her craziness is not as much craft as it is just general reaction to what was going on around her.
But her experience is sort of like the stuff of legend now.
And what it gets, though, in the end, like, you know, you got to give the guy props for knowing what he was going for, is you get somebody who we feel so much for, we feel so sorry for. She's just, you know, like, she's, I'm almost at a loss for words at the role of this movie, because she's so warm and she's so loving. And, you know, she's got an alcoholic husband. She's got a son who talks to himself. They're living in this little dive of a place in Denver. And, you know, she goes into a situation that's infinitely worse and barely makes it out without going nuts herself.
Yeah.
And I just think that, you know, maybe that was yet another thing that was missing from Escape from Tomorrow. If we had have felt something for the wife besides, my God, what a bitch.
Exactly.
You know, maybe it would have given the whole movie something so much better.
Yeah, no, it's true. The Shelley Duvall is just, I'm just, there's a lot with her. When I was growing up, I did not like the performance.
Mm.
I didn't think it was good. and I've completely done a 180 on that. I think that there's just something so instinctual about it. There's something, like you said, just very warm about her earlier scenes. Something very sad about her want to please this guy who is just horrible to her. That scene where she's like, I'll make some sandwiches. And he's just like, he freaks out on her about, you can't come in here while I'm working and everything. And just, she's just sort of, she's pretty weak-willed, but then she sort of finds that strength to get her and her kid out of this just horrifying situation. It's exhausting. Exhausting to watch.
The thing too is that it's a natural progression, right? We see her go from very friendly to really worried and concerned about what's going on with her husband to kind of afraid to full on freaked out. If she had have started, you know, as even just kind of afraid, we might not care. But because there's this beautiful descent, we really feel for her. And, you know, I'm also kind of thinking, you mentioned earlier, you've kind of got a thing for, like, big saucer-sized eyes.
Shining really does a number on me, I guess.
It really does.
So much of that film is about people staring at other people in this very hypnotized, suspended way. I've been trying to figure out what it is about this film's atmosphere besides just Kubrick doing his thing that really, like, sticks with me. And I've figured out that with all the Steadicam and for all of the fluidity of the camera, there are so many moments that are almost like frozen in time.
Yeah.
Have to do with characters staring at other characters, whether it's Danny staring at Halloran or, you know, Jack staring out or, you know, just Wendy looking terrified. There's just so much wide-eyed staring going on. And it's just, these moments are just so, they're so hypnotizing and you just get so stuck in them. And just that moment where Dick Halloran, where he's in bed.
Yeah.
That terrifies me.
Really?
And absolutely terrifies me. And then those cuts out of nowhere to Danny screaming for each of the traumatic things that are happening that he's seeing. And we just cut to his, like, shaking face that is just so, so terrorized. It's just all of that stuff. It really gets on my skin.
Oh, definitely. I'm going to cut it here because I think we could be talking about The Shining for hours. But it, like, you know, this is the movie. I think I try not to go into a film with expectations, but when I sat down for something like Escape from Tomorrow, I had in mind, you know, family goes into situation, somebody starts to kind of go off their rocker. This is the template in every way, shape, and form, both in story and in technique. And it was kind of funny watching this movie last night on Halloween with the apartment to myself. I the one thing I kind of noticed, you were talking about the look, the sound in this movie is insane. Like I found myself wondering last night, and I'm sure again, I could look up the answer pretty easily, is, you know, how Danny and his big wheel, like rolling around the hotel, and he hits floor, and he hits carpet, and he hits floor, and you hear different sounds coming out of the wheels. And it almost sounds like it's a live mic. But then I say to myself, well, wait, if it was a live mic, how are they not picking up the wheels of the camera?
Yeah, that's true.
You know, so, but so it's perfectly done to make it sound like it's happening then and there, but there's just so much craft going on. And, you know, that heartbeat sound that permeates the soundtrack. Oh my God, this movie's so good.
Yeah. And so, I gotta just give a final shout out to, Wendy Carlos and her score.
Oh yeah.
Is absolutely just harrowing to listen to.
You take that score out of this.
The synthesizers and the bellowing howls and all of it. I can't even, so much of that film's success has to do with what she's done with her music and the other music that Kubrick uses elsewhere.
Totally. Just before we leave this, did you ever see Room 237?
I did.
And?
I personally wasn't crazy about it, but I think it's worth watching.
Oh, cool. There we go. Well, there we go. Two great films and one not so much. And put it all together, you've got episode 98 of the Matinee Cast. Come on back on Monday, November 18th for episode 99, where we'll discuss Nebraska, depending on whether or not it comes out in time. Catherine's work can be found at
Cine Enthusiast, so it's C-I-N-E-N and enthusiast.wordpress.com.
There we go. And you also contribute stuff to Verite magazine. Do you have anything coming up in the next week or so that people can look forward to?
I've been doing this thing where I take a year in film and try to rewatch things and watch a bunch of stuff and create like a fun top 10 list to my own like sort of personal taste. And I'm working on 1983 right now, and that should be up within the next 2 weeks.
Nice. And if people want to follow you on Twitter, where can they find you?
Cinephile24.
There we go. My site is thematinee.ca. For more audio content, you can find back episodes by going to thematinee.ca/podcasting. You can also find them on Stitcher Radio, Apple's podcast app, and the iTunes Store. They all give you ways to subscribe for free and get alerts when new episodes drop. And I'm going to be a pest and say, if you don't mind, I would really love a few ratings in the iTunes Store. It'll help me raise the profile of the show. Feedback on Escape from Tomorrow, on changing films endings on Alice in Wonderland or The Shining can be left in the comment section of the site. You can email me, ryan@thematinee.ca, Twitter, where I'm matinee_CA, or Facebook, facebook.com/darkmatinee. Catherine, any final thoughts before we call it a night?
Don't see Escape from Tomorrow. But also, thank you so much for having me on.
I was going to say, for, you know what? For your first podcast, you did pretty darn well. So I hope this is the first of many.
Oh, thank you so much.
There we go. For Catherine, I'm Ryan. We'll see you at the matinee. Find me in the matinee, the dark of the matinee, bedroom.